those of you who just joined, if you're wondering what we're doing in Parashat Vayishlach, in chapter 33, in verse 17, it was that we were chasing a search for the word Sukkot so that we could get an understanding of its origins, of its essence, of where Sukkot first makes its appearance in Torah. So there was this concept of Sukkot way before Hashem built the Sukkot for us that he did in the desert. And they are, it's a very important reference for us, because if we drop this pin at the end of chapter 33, the thing we would most have to do is say, well, what prompted Yaakov to build this house and then also build these Sukkot? And in the past, as a class, I taught this in Israel. I'm going to repeat parts of it today because I think it's important for the finale. The question that is being asked, that I'll ask, which I think is the obvious one, is what context do these Sukkot appear in? What is the context of this story? What happened? I know we know that Yaakov is known for building Matzevot. We know he says he's going to build God a Bayit. He's going to build Bet El, and he's very much into construction. Yaakov does a lot of this in his journey from his parents' house to Lavan and on the way home. So with all of these building permits, so to speak, what do we, the reader, learn if we follow and trace Yaakov? So the easiest thing to do is if we went to the beginning of Vayishlach, we would understand the frame of mind that Yaakov was in when he built his Sukkot, and then maybe we can get an understanding of our own frame of mind when we build our own Sukkot. So in the beginning, it's not so easy. It's a little bit concerning, actually, because in the beginning of Parashat Vayishlach, Yaakov is in a very precarious position. He's sending messengers to his brother Esav. He's sending messengers to Seir. And he's concerned and he's afraid, and the language, verb after verb, goes on to say that he is in a state of, you could say, either anxiety, panic, fear. His actions all speak to the fears that he has. He's afraid in the one case that Esav is going to come and he's going to attack him, and he's going to maybe attack one half of his camp and the other half will be able to possibly run away and save their lives. His messengers had come back and they said, we went to visit your brother Esav and we took him all of these gifts, but you should know that he's coming to greet you with 400 men. These are all important verses for us to start to understand our own phobias and our own senses of reality and the pictures that we paint for ourselves. So Yaakov hears his brothers coming to greet him with 400 men, and most of the commentaries say he's preparing for war. That amount of men usually means that there is an army that's coming out to greet him. And as he goes through this whole story, he uses strange language. He says, maybe he's going, I'm afraid of him, he says specifically. He prays to God. He says, Hatzileni na miyad achi, miyad Esav. Please, God, save me from the hands of my brother, from the hands of Esav, because yare anochi oto. I am, in this case, I'm going to say he is incomplete. Because why? Because Esav has the ability to hit him or smite him. He kani im albanim, the mothers, the children. He may not take into account the universal laws of war, of protecting women and children. Or perhaps he might think that Esav still holds a grudge on Rivka for that whole beracha deception that took place. So as we're getting into our Sukkot story, We can't help but be saddled with this a past that Yaakov is saddled with. His past is coming to haunt him. And I've said in classes previously, I'll repeat it again, it's my strong belief that Yaakov is undergoing this soul-searching experience because for him, it's his Yom Kippur. He is going through a typical Yom Kippur. He uses words like Achapera panav bamincha. Let me do my kippurim. Let me do my kapara. Let me give him gifts. Let me pay for what I have done, for what I have taken. Please take birkati miyadi. Take my beracha from my hand, he says. And over we see this kind of language where Yaakov is feeling a sense of either remorse or shame or fear over what transpired between him and his brother. And the language is used, ula yisa panai. You know, we use the word nasot panim, yisa Hashem panav elecha. It's language that we would want God to do to us, that he would uplift our face. So we also get the sense with Yaakov that he's not just praying that his brother forgive him, but he realizes that his actions with his brother have a consequence in Shamayim as well. And so if we start to establish this idea that Yaakov is going through a kippur, a soul-searching process, that is what's going to start to bring him to Sukkot. That's what's going to be the propellant for him to get to Sukkot. And then, of course, that's an easy way for us to say, well, it makes a lot of sense. We go through our Yom Kippur, and then we come to get to our Sukkot as well. So that correlation seems to be a pretty simple one. But I'd like to go a little deeper, and I'd like to ask some obvious psychological questions. And the most glaring question that comes to mind to me when I first started looking at this and assessing and asking, because ultimately we want it to relate to us and we want to be able to see how it speaks to us. And the question is, yes, Yaakov was prepared, milchama, tefillah, matana. We read all of these things that he prepared with gifts and he prepared for war and he prepared with prayer. But the truth of the matter is, when all is said and done, did he overreact? Did he overdo it? And the reason I ask that question is because he never needed to go to war. Esav was a pussycat. He was expecting to encounter a roaring lion. And I might go as far to say that according to the Peshat, Esav was a pure gentleman. He offered to help him. He offered to carry the children. He offered to change his pace so that Yaakov could come with him. And it forces us that, again, if you read the Peshat, there are a lot of midrashim that say that a lot of what Esav said was tongue-in-cheek. But really, that's not the way it's presented. That's not the way the text portrays the meeting, the famous meeting of Yaakov and Esav. So we, the reader, have a responsibility. And we have to ask ourselves the question, because if we don't ask this, we're not going to learn for our own selves. And the question is, what was Yaakov really so afraid of? Because if he was afraid that Yaakov, that Esav was going to attack him, he was wrong. Esav does not attack him. Esav doesn't even want his gifts. He literally, Yaakov has to push them and shove them on Esav and insist that he takes them. Please take them. So he doesn't want his money. He doesn't want to massacre him or his family, which says, okay, I'm not getting anywhere if I try to analyze Esav. I really have to analyze Yaakov, because Yaakov is every one of us. He's one of the Avot. And in this whole story, in Vayishlach, he goes from being Yaakov to being Israel, and he goes to building houses and building Sukkot. He can't build these Sukkot out of nowhere. He only gets to build Sukkot once he goes through a specific process. And that's what I'd like to talk about today. So in doing a study, I'll call it that, I decided, because I didn't know what else to do, how to get to the bottom of it, I reread the story of Yaakov and Esav about to meet each other, and I noticed that the word achiv, brother, appeared exactly 7 times in this story in Vayishlach, where it says, Vayishlach Yaakov malachim lefanav el Esav achiv. Every time that the word achiv or ach was mentioned, it always referred to Esav. Esav is mentioned 7 times as the brother. And I started to think to myself and I said, you know, this scenario, Yaakov must have been thinking to himself of a previous scenario of 2 brothers, perhaps where one wanted to kill the other. Then I said, you know, let's go look at the story of Cain and Hevel. And sure enough, in the story of Cain and Hevel, the word brother also appears exactly 7 times. I said, okay, beauty, we have something going here. Yaakov must think to himself that his brother Esav wants to kill him the way Cain killed his brother Hevel. And that's where the thought process was going, was heading in that direction, and it was a beautiful parallel because both stories have the word brother 7 times. There was only one problem with that assessment, is that in the story of Cain and Hevel, every time it said the word achiv, that brother, every time, was always Hevel, meaning in our story, the brother's always Esav. In the Bereshit story, the brother is always Hevel. And I believe the Torah is asking us to say, hold your horses. You're so used to seeing as Esav as the bad guy, because later on he does become Seir, Sedom. He does become, the rabbis say that the Roman Empire actually has its roots with Esav. And so the conditioning for us to paint Esav with this red Admoni Kulo Ke'aderet Se'ar, to paint him as this red, bloodthirsty person is going to be very natural. But the Torah is giving us in its own little subtle way and saying, hey, you know what? In this story of Yaakov and Esav, Esav is the brother. Just like in the story in Bereshit, Hevel was the brother. It's hard, it's counterintuitive, it takes a lot of effort. It takes a big person to say, wait a minute, all this time I thought I was the victim. Yaakov is preparing for war, waiting to be victimized by his brother. Never in a million years did he think to himself that maybe what? Maybe, just maybe, his brother Esav was the one who was victimized here. Maybe his brother Esav is being paralleled to Hevel because at this point, and again, I know we're not in an open class, but if I could see your expressions, I could read your minds, I would imagine you thinking to yourselves, but didn't Esav send his son Eliphaz to go kill Yaakov? He may have, but none of that is expressly written in the Peshat. We don't see, and didn't Esav say, as soon as my father dies, Yekrevu Yemeh, my father's going to die, and then I'm going to come and kill my brother? Didn't he say that? And I would like to respond, and for a minute at this point, and I'm going to use the words Ba'asher Husham, just like Yishmael at that point was worthy of God's compassion, at this point, you cannot incriminate a Sav for anything. Yes, he did say that those were his intentions, but 22 years passed, and Lavan's house was not a fortress. And in the 22 years that Esav could have done something, he did nothing. It didn't take a rocket scientist to hunt down Yaakov. I mean, he was a shepherd with no tools, in open air, in Uncle Lavan's house. I think he would know how to find his way to Uncle Lavan's house if he really wanted to kill his brother. And the fact that the anger in which he said it at the time and never acted on it, that's actually to his credit. And so as we start to look at this story, and it's not just to study about the psychoanalysis of Yaakov and Esav, but it's to teach us a lesson of ourselves. Very often we see situations and we see ourselves as the victim, and when we see ourselves as the victim, we start to formulate our actions to correspond with our victimness, so to speak. What do I mean by that? Because Yaakov saw himself as the Hevel who's about to get killed by his big, mean brother, he goes through this whole entire process, which is actually an exercise in futility, because none of these things happen to him that he imagines. And now Torah comes and tells us, guess what? Maybe when you look at yourselves, maybe when you process, maybe when you have a dispute, or maybe in your Ben Adam LeChavero assessment, maybe we're too quick to play the role of the victim, and we're not so honest with ourselves, because the honesty part is a very hard part. How hard is it to look in the mirror? I'll use Yaakov as the example and say, oh my gosh, Esav is not Cain. Esav is Hevel. He's the innocent one. Now, here's the worst part. If that's the case, back into the text we go. I said, let me try this and see what happens. How many times does Yaakov's name appear in his story in Vayishlach? A strange number. The number is 16. And just for the heck of it, just for the sake of saying we crossed our T's and dotted our I's, I went and looked at how many times Cain's name appears in his story. And please try this at home and please verify this. I don't even have to tell you, because if it wasn't 16, I wouldn't be bringing it up in the class. So Cain, correlating with Yaakov, is a very scary thing for us. It's scary because it's saying, don't just look and see things from one perspective. Always go stand in somebody else's shoes, so to speak. That's the Yom Kippur that I'm talking about, that's going to bring us towards our Sukkot story. So now, with this background and this backdrop, where Yaakov going to Sukkot time, now I can read the Pasuk for you again, and maybe now we can start to have a better understanding. So right before verse 17, where we have our trifecta, where we have the word Sukkot appearing three times, I just want to, just to prove my point, verse 13, for instance, Yaakov tells Esav, when Esav tells him, please come, Nis'a ve'nelecha ve'elcha lenedecha, come on, let's travel together. We will be one. We will be brothers. It seems like there is an invitation for the unity. It seems like Esav is holding out an olive branch. It seems like Esav is saying, let's be the fulfillment of the blessing. Let's be the fulfillment of the prophecy of Rivka that said, let's get together. Let us strengthen each other. Let us live up to the potential that we had since the womb. I know I'm glorifying this. And I know I'm playing the violins and I'm making a romantic story of what could have been. And we all know that this doesn't happen. But I do need to point this out because I want to say that there are ideals in text. And when we just take Esav and put a red marker on him, and the kids come home with the project where he's drawn in all red and black, and then Yaakov is all drawn in light blue with a talit and a kippah, we're not doing a service to humanity. These are brothers, and their parents are Yitzchak and Rivka. So we need to give them a minute. And I'm saying that because the people that we most often have issues with are the people closest to us. The people that are our own brothers, our own sisters, our own family members, we interact with the most, and they have the greatest ability to hurt us or to harm us or to have us be resentful of. So I'm bringing you back to these brothers. And look what Yaakov answers. He says, oh, you know, the children, they're, you know, going at a slow pace, and the son and the bakar, they're still very, they're still newborn. We can't push them. If we push them too hard, they'll die. And, you know, why don't you go ahead, says Yaakov, and I'll go at my own pace. And Esav says, "Atziga na imcha min ha'am." I don't even think we ever pay attention to these words. Esav says, "Please, let me assign some of my people to you. Let me give you escorts so that they can carry and bring your people up to speed with me." Again, I'm reading this to you from the text because I think it's important that we understand what Sukkot is really about. And so this is coming right before our Sukkot story. And he answers him and he says, I can't understand why or how I'm finding favor in your eyes. But on that day, when Yaakov refuses to reconnect with his brother Esav, and there are commentaries who say, had Yaakov connected with Esav at this point, it's possible that they could have both built each other up. But Yaakov goes his way, Esav goes his way to Seir, and from there, Yaakov goes to Sukkotah. Yaakov goes to this place that's called Sukkotah. Let's look at it again. Vayiven lo bayit. He builds for himself a house. Now, first of all, a lot of this doesn't make sense. Who builds an entire house when the next verse, verse 18, you're going to Shechem? You're going to go somewhere else. We don't build permanent houses. And if you're going to build a permanent house, then what's these next words? And this is where Rabbi Foreman came in, and I found his... I didn't know what to do with this verse for many years until I saw what he wrote about the word miknehu. I had always imagined that miknehu didn't just have to be cattle, that he built corrals for his cattle, because that didn't make sense. But he does a beautiful job, and I don't make commission or anything like that. I'm just suggesting it's a very nice read, and he has a beautiful tone, and his way is very simple to understand. But he played with this word miknehu, and he said a kinyan. He actually used it to describe Adam and Eve. He actually used it to describe the way a man acquires a wife. And he says very cleverly and beautifully that the words for acquiring are very strange. It says in the Mishnah, Ha'isha niknet bishlosha devarim. A woman is bought with three things. That we're familiar with, right? You have to clothe her, and you have to be personal with her, and you have to give her all her needs. And he says that doesn't make sense. Why would you use the word kinyan to purchase, to acquire? You buy a pair of shoes, you buy a horse, you don't buy a wife. A wife, it still doesn't make sense. And he goes on, and he talks about the first set of the first married couple, Adam and Chava. And he says, man has to leave his family, v'davak be'ishto, and has to cling to his wife. Then we start to feel a little better about it, but he still, as we, don't feel so comfortable with objectifying the woman and making her a property or making her something that is bought or that is purchased. And then I'll just bring you to his end. He does a much better job of it than me. I'm just bringing you to the punchline of it. By the end of his thesis, he says the word niknet or kinyan or miknehu doesn't mean to buy or to acquire, nor does it mean to control, because we control the things that we purchase, that we have ownership over. But yet, he uses the phrase, HaTorah niknet be'arba'im u'shmona devarim. The way we acquire Torah is by these 48 qualities, so to speak. Basically, to make his story in shortened, he comes to the understanding that whenever we see this word niknet or kinyan, he replaces it with the word responsibility. And he says clearly that mikne or kinyan, like a wife or like Torah, means to have a responsibility towards something. And now you might be a little happier when we go back into our pasuk and say, what does Yaakov recognize when he comes to Sukkota? Let's talk about his story. He leaves his parents' house, he goes to Haran, meets up with Lavan, marries Leah, then marries Rachel, has all of these kids, and is now 22 years later coming home. I think Lavan is the one who said it best. Lavan says, let's look in chapter 31. He says it beautifully, and we didn't pay so much attention to it when he said it at the time, but now I think it's important that we give it its proper due. When Lavan comes chasing after him, and he thinks that Yaakov has his terafim, Lavan and Yaakov are about to come to an agreement, and they're about to make some type of a treaty. And in verse 43, I'm in chapter 31 in Sefer Bereshit, verse 43, Vaya'an Lavan Vayomer. Lavan answers Yaakov, and he says something, and maybe today we have an appreciation for it. Today, Sukkot, we're appreciating what Lavan told Yaakov, because I think the message is for us today. He says, Habanot benotai, vehabanim banai, vehatzon tzoni, vekol asher ataro elihu. Ulibnotai, what could I do? I can't help, I can't speak for the children that they've had or the babies that they've given birth to. What he's saying, Lavan, is, and this is important, is, you know something, Yaakov? Since you married my daughters, they were always still my daughters. Do you know why they stayed my daughters? You know why? Because you never built them a house. You stayed in my house. What did God say about Adam? Adam, you're supposed to leave your parents' house and you're supposed to cling to your wives, but not in their father's house. You're supposed to build a house for yourself, for them, and start your own family. And all of a sudden now, for the first time, believe it or not, that Yaakov has to protect and defend his wives. They are now, he's seeing them as his kinyan. He's seeing those wives as his responsibility. He's seeing them as people that he is responsible for and responsible to. All of a sudden, when Yaakov comes to the awareness, that's when he builds that bayit, so to speak. Now, whether the bayit that he built in our verse that has the Sukkot, whether it was a physical home, and we play with these words, vayivin lo bayit. Who did he build a house for? We sink our teeth into that verse. We can go back now to chapter 33, verse 17, when it says, vayivin lo bayit, for all we know, he built a house for who? Maybe built a house for Esav. I don't know. It's possible. The text supports it. Vayivin lo bayit. Maybe built a house for God. That's possible too. The text supports that too. He said he was going to build God a house. Maybe he didn't just build a physical house for himself. Maybe he built a house of himself. And what does that mean? We know that we are receptacles for Shekhinah, that we could build ourselves as homes, as temples, right? The Va'asu li mikdash v'shachanti betocham. Maybe he made of himself a mikdash so God could reside within him. And all of those things are fantastic, but to get to our Sukkot story, ulemiknehu asa Sukkot. Ulemiknehu asa Sukkot means something hopefully completely new, thanks to the Rabbi Foreman definition. Meaning what? For those things that he was responsible for and responsible to, he made Sukkot for them. Now, why would you make Sukkot? We still have the question, we still have the problem. Why would you put them in a temporary dwelling? Why wouldn't you put them in the bayit, which is what we would have thought would happen, right? And that's why the name of the place is called Sukkot. So in order to really understand this, we can't just isolate the fact that Sukkot were first built by Yaakov. We have the privilege, or we have the benefit of the whole history in front of us. You know what God was doing when he built Sukkot for us? When God was building, let's go from the beginning. We know that there are three regalim, and for a second I saw a chat from Paula, let me see if I could find it, where she said something about the heel, because I wanted to say about the regalim. Paula, Yaakov's name from birth implies the underdog, the downtrodden heel. He lived with his self-fulfilling prophecy. Oh, wow. Paula. Okay, I'm going to read what she wrote because this is crazy. This is fantastic. She wrote, Yaakov's name from birth, Yaakov, the Ekev, implies the underdog, the heel, the downtrodden. And then she says, he lived with this self-fulfilling prophecy. And that's what allowed him to feel that he was the victim all of his life. Wow, Paula, I'm sorry. I rarely go back into the chat, but it caught my eye when you wrote heel, and I'm glad you said it because I wanted to see if anybody else said anything. Okay, that was great. Rachel, I agree. It's an interesting observation. And then Paula said that's why his name was changed to Yisrael. Beautiful. And then somebody, Jew, maybe a Judy, wrote, Kayan's name, I love that, comes from the word Kinyan. Yes, I'm so happy that you made that connection. There's so many things to say here. I'm going to start with this last person that wrote in. I don't know who you are. It just says J-U on my side. Maybe if I click on it, it'll say who. It is Judy. I don't know which Judy it is, but whoever you are, thank you. You said a great thing also, meaning, you know what? If Yaakov is going to be compared in the Torah, having his name 16 times, like Cain's name 16 times, so at least get the understanding that you need to be a kinyan, a koneh, a person who is responsible. Take responsibility for your actions. This is part of the beauty. So I want to take us back to the totality of Sukkot in Torah. If we went really to say like Hasket, for instance, that on Sukkot is the time that we're supposed to gather. Sukkot is the time that we start to recognize the Shemitah. It's the time that we have the Hakhel where we read the Torah to everybody together. All of those are great things. But to really get a sense of Sukkot, we really have to see how it applies to our relationship with God. What do I mean? Let's go from the beginning. So we leave Egypt. We know that it's one of the three regalim. That's how we got sidetracked with the word regel. The three regalim. The three times they're called really regalim because we go up by foot to Yerushalayim these three times a year. And the three regalim are Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot. Sukkot is the last of the trifecta. What if we saw these three holidays that God is saying we need to celebrate together? We need to see the Pene HaAdon. We need to see the face of our Master on these three holidays. What if we said to ourselves that Pesach is when God takes us? He engages with us. Let's say like a married couple. We have an engagement because velakachti, he takes us as his. He sees us as his am segula, as his nation, as his chosen one. And he chooses us. And that's what happens on Pesach. When we get to Shavuot, and if we want to say that that's Matan Torateinu, it's the time of the giving of the Torah, let's say it for our sake today, that is our Ketubah. That's where God puts in writing the contract, the commandments, what it's going to take for us to be together with him. So he takes us on Pesach, we sign the Ketubah, on Shavuot, what might we say Sukkot is? Sukkot is the chuppah. Sukkot is the actual marriage. It looks like a chuppah. Sukkot is where God is going to take the responsibility for us to make sure, like a husband, like no harm comes to us and our needs are all met. And we are going to be protected by him. And in this understanding of Sukkot, we start to get a sense of what the truth of the Sukkah really represents. You know, when we go into our Sukkah, yes, we think of it as a temporary dwelling. I had made a short video for the SEA, and I'll try and repeat it in short, but I think it's important that we have the full picture. If we're going to say that the only way we could come into the Sukkah is having gone through the Yom Kippur, is having gone through the soul searching, is having gone through the process where we're responsible. And we're not just, when we say we're taking responsibility for ourselves, for who we are, for who we've become, for how we see things, for how we process things, for how we judge ourselves, how we judge others. We also take responsibility for the way that we build our relationships. How are we building our relationship with other people? How are we building our relationship with God? This whole story has to happen before we could come on the wedding day, so to speak, before we could come into the chuppah that is being prepared. And what's so beautiful about Sukkot is, if in the desert, God was the one who built the Sukkot for us, what's so beautiful here is that we're taking the responsibility and we're saying, God, you did everything for us. You gave us the man, you protected us, you did what you needed to do on your end of this whole engagement and marriage period. And now to continue on every anniversary of that marriage, we're going to set the table, we're going to create a space that is saying, we want to welcome you here. And the analogy that I gave is the sukkah, the literal physical space of the sukkah. When we enter that, we have the sukkah and then we have our schach. But right above the schach is what? Right above the schach is shamayim. You have to be able to see the stars, you have to be able to see the sky, because you have to be able to recognize that this spot where your sukkah is, that's where Shekhinah is touchdown. That's where it's touching earth. So if we want to say that God took us out of Mitzrayim to make us these mamlechet kohanim, this kingdom of kohanim, then how is it that we are like a melech? What makes us a king? What makes us a king is exactly what made Moshe our king in the desert. He stood by Ohel Moed, where God was, and where did we all stand? When he bowed and he prostrated and he prayed and he asked for us to be forgiven in front of Ohel Moed, well, each one of us had our own Ohel Moed Katan, so to speak. We each did that by our own tents. We stood by our own tents and we recognized that our tent, our space, has the ability to bring Shekhinah as well. Look, today more than ever, I don't know what's gonna be. I'm tired of stressing or having anxiety over it. When they tell us what's going to be, we'll react to it at this point. But the numbers are not healthy for the virus in our neighborhoods, and it's very possible that we're going to have to retreat back into our private spaces, and we're going to have to put safety first and do what we need to do to stop the spread of a deadly virus. I hear it. So if that's the case, I'd like to suggest our personal sukkah, our personal tent, our personal homes. These are places that have the ability to bring Shekhinah. We can't knock down the or feel dejected that we can't go to a public place of worship. We have to take our private spaces, our private places, our sukkahs, our homes, and turn those into small mikdashim, into places that God says, yes, here is where I'm going to reside. And that's, I believe, part of the Sukkot energy that exists, is it should empower us. It should make us feel that we're not helpless and we're not marginalized and nobody shut the door in our face. We're the ones that are building the sukkah. We're the ones that are creating it. One space, they say God closes a door, we open a window. If the shuls get shut down, our houses and our hearts and our sukkot and our personal spaces have to remain open. And maybe that's the way that we're going to get back to basics. Maybe getting back to basics is going to mean first creating vayiven lo bayit, first creating a bayit of ourselves and not allowing anybody else or having to take the easy way out and walking into a bayit that somebody else built. No. Vayiven lo bayit. You know what Yaakov really did? Yaakov had to go through the soul searching to build himself up. And maybe he did, and maybe he didn't acknowledge that sometimes we have to change the way we see things. And maybe we're not the victims here. I don't know. It's there's so much to look at here. But I will say this, and I was thinking very much of all people about Boaz. I'm just going to read this verse to you, because when I say that Yaakov had to build Sukkot for his Miknehu, it's like those couples that go on a second honeymoon, or they renew their vows, or you hear these kinds of things. I believe for the first time in Yaakov's life, he recognized the full extent of the responsibility that he had to his wives, and that he had to build them a home that he provided. I'm going to build on that with what takes place with when Boaz is going to take root. The people in the Am that were in the Sha'ar and the Zekenim, what do they say? Yiten Hashem et ha'isha haba'a el betecha. We say this at many weddings. Many communities have this custom to say this. Kerachel ukelea asher banu shtehem et bet Yisrael ve'aseh chayil be'efrata ukrashem bevet lachem. What the people are saying is, when you take this woman, Ruth, and it's beautiful because the terminology that's used when he's speaking to Ploni Almoni and he's speaking to the people about acquiring Ruth, he uses this word and he says, Beyom kanotcha hasadeh miyad Naomi. Kanita lehakim et shem hamet. The idea of kinyan, and I think that's what was lost originally, is you don't just get to buy the field at a bargain. Kinyan means you have to take a responsibility for these people that are part of your life. And so today I'd like to suggest that Yaakov building a sukkah is a reminder for us to say, we need to build a chuppah. And a chuppah doesn't just mean a place for our spouse. That's our physical chuppah that we may have an imagery of. The sukkah is a chuppah like hekel, that, and we have ushpizin. We invite the past. We invite the present. I believe we're inviting a beautiful future when we do this. And what we're really doing when we come into the sukkah is we are forming relationships in a healthy way with the people that we are responsible, with the God that has protected us, that we are now renewing our vows to, and we're making it a place of safety, of shalom. My prayer this Sukkot more than ever is that every person's sukkah is a place that energizes all of its inhabitants with all of the healing power that comes through the sukkah and into every single sukkah. And so I'm going to end with this. Not of course we pray for the refuah of Le'abat Yitol. We pray for the refuah of the people who have been stricken by any illness or any disease. But we also pray that we recognize that we have the ability to build spaces that will bring a tremendous amount of positive energy into our lives and into our world. And so with that, I wish you all a Chag Sameach. I'm going to look at the chat quickly. Oh, Jew. That was you, Judy Schwartz. I thought it was you.